outside a clinical trial here in the United Kingdom. Now, this is the beginning of a mass inoculation initiative that Britain and indeed the whole world hope will signal the beginning of the end of this pandemic. But has the government built enough trust with the public? Bianca Rahimi finds out in this report.
Here in the UK, Margaret Keenan, who turns 91 next week, has received what she calls an early birthday present, the first of 800,000 doses of the COVID-19 vaccine developed by Pfizer and BioNTech. She has been self-isolating alone since March and was pleased to get the jab.
I thought it was a joke, to tell you the truth, to start with. I couldn't believe it, you know, but I'm happy it's happened, and now I've done it, and hopefully it'll help other people come along.
At this initial phase, the elderly, vulnerable and NHS staff have been given priority. The effects of the vaccine are expected to kick in 12 days after administration, and Margaret and everyone else receiving the jab will have another dose in 3 weeks. Full immunity can be expected a month after the first dose. In the meantime, people are being asked to stick to the rules.
My message would be, it's amazing to see the vaccine coming out. It's amazing to see this tremendous shot in the arm for the entire nation, but we can't afford to relax now.
The scientists say life might start to go back to normal by April. The British government is touting this as a success for the United Kingdom, being the first to approve a vaccine. In an interview Tuesday morning, Health Secretary Matt Hancock broke down.
Just simple words there, reacting it. You're quite emotional by that.
Well, it's just, it's been such a tough year for so many people, and there's William Shakespeare putting it so simply for everybody that, you know, we can get on with our lives. And you know, there's still a few months to go. I've still got this worry that we can't blow it now, Piers. We've still got to get the vaccine to millions of people, and so we've got to keep sticking by the rules. But it's just, you know, there's so much work gone into this, and I'm really, really, it makes you proud to be British.
However, diminishing trust in the government has led to a lot of scepticism about the vaccine.
I think given the effects it's having, it's probably worth the risk. Not that I believe there is a risk, but I'd definitely be willing to take it.
Not right now. Do you know, it's too quickly. Like, the vaccine was made way too quickly for my own likings, and I don't think it's been tested well enough. And if it was possible to put a vaccine through this quickly, why haven't they done it before?
Because there's a pandemic going on around the world, and I don't think there's any conspiracy about it. And I've had vaccines when I was a little boy, and I'll take a vaccine now.
According to the largest survey of UK attitudes and behaviour during the pandemic, a fifth of people are likely to refuse a COVID vaccine. More than half believe that vaccines can cause unforeseen effects. And more than a third think natural immunity is better than immunity from vaccines.
Critical mass of people are going to have to get the vaccine in the coming weeks and months for it to work. The UK hasn't made it mandatory, so it might be a bit of an uphill job for the government to convince everyone that it is necessary and safe. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Well, Lembit Opeth, the former MP and political commentator, is with us. And Lembit, as somebody who perhaps is still feeling the impact of COVID that you contracted just a couple weeks ago, Pfizer has been given legal protection by the government. Does that make you feel a little bit more easy in the mind?
First of all, I wish this vaccine had existed 2 months ago so that I could avoid the worst November I've had in decades. I'm recovering from the disease now, and there's no doubt if we have a successful vaccine, that's great. My concern is the one that's been expressed in your piece there. There's always going to be a risk if you rush something which is biologically significant to the human body, that you have unforeseen side effects, unforeseen circumstances which cause other problems. Now, what's the balance here? In reality, I think it's probably better that they do this. But let's recognize there's a political dimension here as well. Britain wanted to be the first in the world to implement the vaccine. They've achieved that with 800,000 vaccines being rolled out now. But there is still that small risk. I think it's probably a risk worth taking.
Now, of course, they won't be mandatory at the moment, but things like traveling and other essential elements of life might require a vaccine passport. What are your thoughts on that?
In the short term, it makes sense if you want to limit the impact not just of people coming into the United Kingdom with the disease, but also people going from the United Kingdom, which is a very high disease risk area in terms of the world at the moment, so that we don't spread it to other countries. So in that sense, having a vaccine passport makes sense. But once again, I'm concerned about the long-term implications here. Britons have given away a lot of freedom, voluntarily by and large, because they've been good corporate citizens, they've wanted to prevent death. But these precedents, if they become rather more restrictive, we could end up in a country where we have biological authoritarianism, where the vaccines become mandatory, you can't travel if you haven't got one. Then we begin to have a civil liberties debate, not one for tonight, but it's one we will certainly return to if this is used as a precedent outside this pandemic.
So will a beleaguered Boris Johnson be breathing a bit easier tonight, Lambeth?
He will be. But he ought to be a bit careful here. A recent YouGov poll puts him at having 34% approval ratings and 58% against him. His party is level pegging with the Labour Party, very close together. He needs this to work. The truth is, that if this vaccine shows a massive decline in the disease, he'll get the benefit from that. But it's also, in some ways, a junk bond. The value of his credibility can go down as well as up. And if there is some terrible byproduct of this which causes different infections, then he'll get hurt by it. He's had to put all his eggs in this basket. The country didn't want to go into 2021 with no hope. But frankly, his political fortunes are probably absolutely intimately connected with the success of this and the other vaccines. That means he's actually handed his future to pharmaceuticals.
Indeed, Lambeth Opec. Thank you, as always. Now we move on to the European Union, where they've rejected the results of Venezuela's parliamentary elections. This saw the president, Nicolas Maduro's political alliance, win some 67% of the seats. More than 14,000 candidates representing 100 or so political parties took part in the election, despite opposition parties, including U.S.-backed Juan Guaido, the former leader of the National Assembly, boycotting the vote. Now, the statement falls in line of that of Washington's. They've also rejected the elections, despite no attempt to concur with international regulators and observers. Western powers are keen to overthrow the socialist government of Nicolas Maduro and have attempted three unsuccessful coups in the past year. Now with us, Isaac Bigio, the political commentator. He's with here for his reactions. Isaac, hi. You surprised by the EU stance here and that it so clearly mirrors that of Washington?
Well, because the European Union has been following what the United States is doing, and perhaps one person can think, oh, now we are seeing that Donald Trump is accusing his own system as fraudulent, and that even Chavez, after being dead, has been able to manipulate the results against him, that the European Union could change. Didn't change. The same day as Venezuela had elections, Romania had elections, and they also had one-third of electors to participate. So the same as Venezuela, but they don't criticize Romania, they only criticize Venezuela. Some European elections have less participation than in Venezuela. Most of the local elections in the United Kingdom and many parliamentarian by-elections have one-third or less of participation, but they don't accuse that of fraudulent. In the Venezuelan election, we have more than 100 parties, most of them from the opposition. You have different right-wing opposition and even a left-wing opposition. But I think that the European Union is always going to follow what Washington says.
And very briefly on this one, Isaac, the U.S., we know, has directly backed multiple coups in just a matter of the last 18 months or so. How can they talk about free and fair polls?
Have you seen Donald Trump accusing his own system as fraudulent? The United States has supported every single dictatorship in Latin America in the last 70 years. None of them has been punished by the Organization of American States. But in Venezuela, they removed the Venezuela from the Organization of American States. They recognized Guaido, a guy that has never been elected by anybody. He couldn't stand in this election because he was not going to have any single vote. In Catalonia, they rejected a referendum organized by the Catalan government.
Indeed.
Despite that 40% of the population vote. But now in Venezuela, they reject a national election and they wanted to implement a referendum which nobody is going to vote. I think that is a double standard. When they want somebody to be punished because this government is against the United States,
indeed,
they will punish the government. If it is a government that for the United States, they will follow that rule.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thank you, as always. Now we move on to Britain here, where the country's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has labelled the latest rounds of Brexit talks as difficult, further adding that the UK would have to decide very soon if there was indeed going to be a no-deal Brexit. With just over 3 weeks before Britain completes its journey out of the bloc, significant differences still remain over trade, state aid and fisheries. And if an agreement is not reached by the 31st of December, the UK and the EU could introduce import charges on each other's goods. Prime Minister Johnson's comments comes just a day after he and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen spoke on the phone and agreed significant differences on key issues remained. The pair have scheduled to meet in person in the next, quote, coming days.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Richard Sudan, Priti Patel, Britain's Home Secretary. Well, is she covering herself in some more glory there?
Well, I mean, we're learning now, Amina, just days after the UK Home Office and Priti Patel went ahead with a number of deportations. The deportees, we believe, were directly related to the Windrush family. Of course, that was a scandal in itself, erupting 2 years ago. And now, just days after this, we find that the Home Office is set for another round of deportations of potential asylum seekers. And invariably, this has raised massive concerns to human rights lawyers and also watchdogs, who are saying that, you know, the government is going to come out with their usual line saying these people must be deported for X, Y, and Z. But experts are actually saying there are potentially people targeted by this move who themselves have been victims of trafficking, human trafficking, and other serious crimes, and they need to have their case further looked at before this decision can be made. In some ways, this doesn't surprise us, but of course, you know, we've become used to this kind of move from the Home Office, but human rights campaigners are understandably furious at the proposals, Amina.
And has this sentiment been reflected in the online reaction?
It certainly has. A lot of people keeping ahead of this issue now. John Brady says, I see Priti Patel is rushing the deportation of asylum seekers to beat the Brexit deadline. This includes people suspected to have been trafficked into the UK. This is the same Priti Patel who said, let the Irish starve during discussions on the impact of Brexit on food supplies. And we have a reaction from Andrea who says, men and women in Brexit Britain are unjustly detained and unlawfully deported. Windrush children suffer the deportation of their parents. The ethical and moral fabric of this country is deteriorating under government threats.
Well, I guess that's what they meant when they say take back control. To your other story now, unfortunately, Richard, whenever we speak, there seems to be just another tragedy, this time once more coming out of the United States and the killing of another unarmed black man.
Another day and another black man dead at the hands of law enforcement, Amina. This time, 23-year-old Casey Goodson, who was shot in Ohio on Friday. Now, almost predictably, the police allege in their account of events that Casey Goodson was holding a gun. But get this, Amina. Casey's own family say he wasn't holding a gun. He was holding a sandwich, and he was actually shot three times in the back whilst entering his own home, front of his grandmother and also a sibling, you know, a child. And, you know, quite apart from the fact that Casey Goodson has had his life taken from him, I can't really imagine the trauma this would have sparked with his family. It's an almost unbelievable state of events. There's been a lot of celebration in recent weeks you know, at the back of Donald Trump as if this is the back of racism. But I mean, if ever
we're
there
clearly
were,
seeing that that's not the case at the moment, or perhaps it's just intensifying feelings in these volatile weeks before the inauguration. Can we move on to the social media reaction on this, Rich?
Sure, let's go to Stans Grounded, who says, Ohio police killed a 23-year-old black man who was walking into his own home with a Subway sandwich. Casey Goodson Jr., the police claim he was waving a gun, but he had a concealed carry license and the police shot him in the back. And Moonzy, also on Twitter, says, his name is Casey Goodson. He was just 23 and he was unjustly taken from his family and from the world. We demand that Franklin County Sheriff's Office takes charge and arrests Deputy Jason Mead and put him under trial for murder. We will not rest until we see justice.
We might have some bad news for Moonzy here, which in many of these cases, the officer is not charged. All right, Richard Sedan, we'll leave it there for the moment. Thank you so much. So some other news now, where EU foreign ministers have begun evaluating grounds for sanctions against Turkey over its claims to hydrocarbon resources in the Eastern Mediterranean. The EU's bloc's leaders will decide at a summit later on in the week on whether to make good on these waves of sanctions. Speaking on the East Med dispute, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Turkey would not bow to threats and blackmail from the EU over its row with Greece. The president added that any plans or maps excluding Ankara from its rights in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea were unacceptable. NATO member and EU candidate, Turkey claims gas resources that are also contested by Greece and Cyprus, a dispute that has had spawned territorial rows over maritime borders. Now, French President Emmanuel Macron announced that concerns over human rights violations in Egypt would not affect the future sale of French arms to that country. Since 2015, France has sold considerable amounts of weapons to Egypt, with Macron voicing concerns that the country would turn to the West's rival, China and Russia, if it did not receive adequate support from Europe. Following Macron's press conference, over 20 human rights groups issued a statement condemning France's strategic partnership with Egypt. The statement accused the Egyptian president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, of human rights abuses in the country, including the cracking down of pro-democracy activists and supporters of his rival, Mohamed Morsi. Well, it seems a Saudi prince is breaking ranks when it comes to the occupation entity. Robert Inlakesh, more details, please.
Well, this is an interesting case, and it can be read in many different ways. So the statements which were made by the prince, the Saudi prince, Turki al-Faisal, of course, these are very accurate claims. He says that it's a Western colonizing power and that it operates concentration camps for Palestinians and it assassinates whoever it wants. These, are, of course, ring true to many ears, but unfortunately, we're looking at Saudi Arabia here, which does a very similar thing in Yemen. It's a close ally of the West and, of course, Israel. We know of the first meeting officially, which just occurred between the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, Netanyahu, and also Secretary of State for the United States, Mike Pompeo. What may have happened here, it could be taken a few different ways. Number one is that it looks like Saudi Arabia are quite enraged at the fact that Netanyahu leaked the fact that this secret meeting was supposed to be secret meeting Saudi Arabia, for one. They're not quite yet ready to normalize ties with Israel. And so perhaps this is sort of pulling away from them, and it's a way of them, you know, signaling that it's not time for them to normalize ties, that they're not ready to go ahead with this. It might be a saving face thing also. And on top of that as well, people have speculated as to whether this is something to do with Iran. Do they want to be seen as such an aggressive party against Iran on the front lines for Israel? Do the Saudis want to subject themselves to possible retaliatory strikes on Saudi Arabia if they formalize ties with Israel and start allowing Israel to even use their territory to commit massacres against Iran and to strike Iranian territory. Do they want to get tangled up in that? And of course, perhaps they do not want to get tangled up in such a thing. So this can be taken many different ways. But of course,
Robert Inlakesh, there could be the idea here that there's not a uniformity of positions inside the House of Saud, that there are actually members of the royal family who thinks this is a bad idea for a variety of reasons.
Absolutely. There is a difference of opinion. Even with the UAE normalization, there's many that were against it that just didn't voice their opinions. We've heard one of the opinions voiced here. And so it does show there's a divide in opinion here. However, Saudi Arabia continues, for instance, to crack down on Palestinians, behead Palestinians, imprison Palestinians for no good reason, of course, and crack down on the Hamas movement and put out false statements about the Hamas movement. So, you know, one Saudi prince stating
reaction to this one.
Well, the first one we've got here is from a user called David. He says, basically saying he says all of these things while sitting at the table at a panel with Gabi Ashkenazi, who's the foreign minister for Israel, and he says, lol. And we've got another one here from an Israeli who says they will never settle with the Jewish state, maybe only for a short time when it suits their interests and if it's not public. I posted previously a photo proof of their anti-Israel training seminars, and that's interesting because, of course, there's many in Saudi Arabia that disapprove of this, and the Israelis are not friendly towards them on a general level.
And we move to your second story. Some interesting words coming out of Brussels for Tehran.
Absolutely. This one, just utter hypocrisy. Trying to paint, you know, the JCPOA as an agreement where it's just an ask and deliver sort of negotiation here. They want Iran basically to hold up their side of the JCPOA when all the other sides have betrayed it. The United States unilaterally withdrew from it. Trump then slapped on these criminal sanctions, which amount to war crimes in some cases against Iran. And the Europeans have not held up their side of the bargain, and they have not gone as far as even attempting to punish Israel, not only for the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, Iran's top scientist, but on top of that, Qasem Soleimani as well. Nothing has been done on the international stage for this. Whilst they're still doing weapons deals, for instance, with Saudi Arabia, with the Persian Gulf states, on unprecedented levels, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of weapons flooding into that region. And they have the audacity to criticize Iran. Many are saying this is ridiculous. Israel has a stockpile of, it's estimated, about 300 nuclear weapons. They haven't signed the non-proliferation agreement. Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program, and it's enriching uranium for other purposes. It's stated as such. There's no body on earth which will state that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. And, of course, it's utter hypocrisy. Why wouldn't Iran even be able to obtain such a thing if it wanted to attain such a thing, for instance? This
and
is just
very powerful responses to this claim.
The first one we have here is from Sayed Mohammed Marandi, who says, in an interview on CNN, I stress that Iran won't accept any changes to the nuclear deal. Nothing will be added or renegotiated. The report implies that this is a bluster. This is a dangerous Western miscalculation. Iran didn't resist 4 years of Trump's barbarism to appease Biden. And then we have another one here that says, fool me once, shame on you, fool me, shame on me. Why should Iran waste time, effort, to entertain a one-sided deal only for another few terms of seesaw political pantomime that ushers in another U.S. patsy that reneges on a deal lauded by honest Western nations? No thanks.
All right, Robert Inlakesh, thank you, as always. And this is where we leave you for this evening. Until next time, stay safe.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The article you're going to hear has been penned by Robert Lewis. Robert Lewis is a lawyer licensed in California. He has worked in leading US, UK, and Chinese law firms in China for nearly 30 years. The article is titled, Under Biden, US Set to Resume Globalist Policies. Stay with us for more of Robert Lewis's article. With Joe Biden's victory in the US presidential election, Donald Trump's America First doctrine will be jettisoned, and Biden will seek to return the United States to pre-Trumpian norms. That is expected to mean a return to the Paris Climate Accord, the Iran nuclear deal, and perhaps even the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Meanwhile, the challenges in the Sino-US relationship will not have magically gone away when Biden takes over, and political matters in relation to China are now so entrenched in the US that no major substantive policy changes may be possible. Fate would have it, Joe Biden and his fellow Democrats again find themselves assuming power in the wake of a global economic downturn. In 2009, it was in the immediate aftermath of the global financial crisis. Now it is in the midst of a renewed lockdowns across Europe and the United States in an effort to try to stop the second wave of COVID-19 infections from overwhelming the healthcare system. It will likely take many months into the Biden administration for vaccines to bring the United States, its allies in the other major industrialized nations and other affected parts of the world back to normal. So there are two parts to the Biden administration's goal of getting things back to normal. There is the pre-Trumpian globalist normal, and then there is the pre-pandemic normal. At some point, he and other Western leaders will have to explain why China and other parts of Asia have been back to normal since the late second quarter of 2020, while a return to normal in the United States and Europe now is not projected to occur until at least the third quarter in 2021 at the earliest. Politicians always deflect blame for problems. Donald Trump blamed China for the pandemic. Joe Biden will blame Donald Trump for any pandemic-related problems going forward. In any event, Biden will have to play the cards he has been dealt, and his performance will be measured by actual results. key component of the global system is trade, and the system is designed to promote more open trade in order to increase global trade volumes and economic development. Donald Trump's America First doctrine is generally understood to be protectionist in nature, and thus presumably anti-trade. His use of tariffs as instruments of trade warcraft similarly has been criticized as antithetical to sound economic and trade principles. However, historical trade statistics over the last decade paint a picture that suggests that continued growth in global trade may not be directly tied to who is in the White House. During the Obama-Biden years, after a steep decline in global export trade volumes in 2009 following the global financial crisis, global exports rebounded rapidly to set new highs for a period of four consecutive years, from 2011 through to 2014, ultimately reaching a peak of $18.9 trillion in 2014. In contrast, in 2015 and 2016, global trade volumes declined by more than 15%, putting global trade levels back on par with pre-crash levels and erasing all the gains in the preceding years. Then comes along a virus. In April of this year, global trade volumes plummeted a remarkable 12.2% in just 1 month. To put this in context, from January of 2010, the monthly change in trade volume had been characterized by an alternating series of small peaks and small valleys, generally with month-on-month increases of no more than 2.5% and decreases of less than 2%. In light of the precipitous drop in trade volumes due to the pandemic, the World Trade Organization WTO projected in April that trade volumes were set to plunge by between 13% and an almost unimaginable 32% for the full year 2020. This dire forecast by the World Trade Organization experts failed to recognize the apparently unstoppable momentum of global trade, even in the midst of a global pandemic. In May, the monthly decline in trade volume was only 0.9%, and the June trade volumes had jumped back into the plus column, giving 7.9%, followed by smaller but still historically high rates of increase over the next 4 months. By early October, the World Trade Organization had revised its guidance to forecast an overall 9.2% decline in trade in goods for 2020, followed by a 7.2% rise in 2021. The forecast drop for 2020 is still sobering, but pales in comparison with the more than 22% decline in global trade in 2009 after the global financial crisis. The forecast 2020 drop is also smaller than the two-year decline of more than 15% in the last part of the Obama-Biden administration. Some additional historical perspective is required to more fully understand the irresistible force of global trade. Even with a modest decline from 2018, as noted above, global trade for 2019 was still up more than 350% over 1995 levels, which were $5.19 trillion, and a remarkable 6,300% higher than 1970 level of trade, which was $302.3 billion. It appears, at least so far, that not even a pandemic can stop the long-term growth of global trade. As author and columnist Zachary Carabel commented in March, "When we assess the prospects for global trade going forward in the full historical context, it would appear more plausible that the most coronavirus future will see not an end to the globalizing trend of recent decades, but a new chapter in the story." Stated otherwise, if Donald Trump and COVID-19 did not derail global trade, maybe nothing can.
the world with reporters.
During Donald Trump's 4 years in office, relations between the European Union and the United States deteriorated so badly that the sides almost became bitter adversaries. Washington's illegal economic sanctions against Iran have prevented EU firms from doing business with the Islamic Republic. Apparently, it is an example of why the bloc needs to become more autonomous.
We don't accept this kind of extraterritoriality, but in practical terms, it has effects. Well, if we don't accept, we should be able to resist it.
Aside from the Iran nuclear deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Trump has pushed back against the EU on trade, climate change, and how to handle COVID-19. Those are only a few examples. EU foreign affairs ministers have just adopted a policy document designed to repair the damage when Joe Biden enters the White House next month. The document states we need to work together to preserve the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action as endorsed by United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231-2015. But despite the EU's seemingly positive ambitions, there are many analysts who agree the nuclear deal will not be saved because ultimately the Biden administration will bow to Israeli regime pressure. Trump's hate speech towards Iran, fueled by the powerful Israel lobby, has been relentless during the past 4 years.
We're going to hit you with a force 1,000 times bigger than you've ever been hit before.
Despite Trump and Israel's best efforts, some expert analysts believe Iran's political leaders can still save the nuclear deal.
It is a sensitive issue. And like in the U.S. Congress, also in the Iranian parliament, there are people who are, if not opposed, at least critical. But the foreign ministry and the government, I think, are very, very determined to carry out this deal.
Biden has said he wants to re-engage with Iran. Tehran has made it clear matters will not be progressed at any price. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
For Brexit supporters and many coastal communities, this deal symbolises regaining sovereignty in an age-old dispute over fishing rights. The UK says British fishing grounds are first and foremost for British boats, but the EU wants things to stay relatively the same with access for its boats and no tariffs or taxes on goods crossing borders. The EU's bargaining chip is special access to the EU single market, which the UK wants to hold on to as 60% of the fish its boats catch is sold to the bloc. The EU says something's got to give, though, insisting Britain cannot have priority access to its own fisheries and the EU market.
Mais comment expliquer aux pêcheurs?
How do we explain to fishermen that they can't go into British waters, but then they import fish to Bologna? That's very complicated, believe me.
Wars have almost been waged over these fishing waters. Britain and Iceland clashed over cod between the 1950s and 1970s, with the Royal Navy deploying 37 warships to protect British interests. The Scallop Wars in 2018 that saw French and British trawlmen come to blows in the English Channel threatened an uneasy truce reached in 2012, when the UK agreed to keep larger boats away from French waters in exchange for additional access rights. Since Britain formally left the EU on January 31st, negotiators have missed a series of deadlines to reach a deal with the world's largest trading bloc before the transition period ends on December 31st. And although the UK hopes these really are the last few days before a deal, it is not ruling out an extension.
I think we probably are now in the final few days in terms of being able to decide whether there can be an agreement. Of course, look, if the ambience warms up again and actually great progress is made and it's just about sorting out the detail, well, then you can always find more time, you can always extend. But I think unless we can resolve these quite fundamental divergences at the moment, then we are going to have to take a position in the next few days.
If a satisfactory deal is not reached, the British economy, which has already been battered by the COVID-19 pandemic, will suffer even more. And it will also mean bilateral trade falling back on World Trade Organization rules for 2021, which is far from Brexit's purported goal of taking back control. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The call on the Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari to resign followed the incessant killings, armed robberies, kidnappings, banditry, and the over a decade insurgency in Nigeria's northeast. Prominent elders, members of civil society organizations, religious leaders, politicians have advised the president to resign because he has failed to live up to the oath of his office to protect the lives and property of Nigerians.
He has failed on his own promises, the promises he freely made to Nigerians in 2015. People can no longer travel from Abuja to Kaduna, a journey of less than 200 kilometers. So what is the essence of being in government if you cannot protect lives and property, which is the basic responsibility of being in governance? This accounts for why Nigerians are asking Mr. President to resign from office.
But Nigeria's Minister of Information has fired back, saying no amount of hysterical calls for resignation will prevent the president from serving out his second term in office. Experts agree that President Muhammadu Buhari has not lived up to the expectations of Nigerians, but resignation is not the way to go. They said citizens-driven security system is a new trend the world over, and Nigerians should get involved.
All the strata of leadership in Nigeria, in general, and in northern Nigeria in particular, to live up to their responsibilities. When we say strata of leadership, it cuts across the military, the political class, the traditional rulers, the religious leaders. They should come, rise up, and face the realities of these particular challenges that is facing northern Nigeria in particular and Nigeria in general. But Buhari should lead the way by example.
But the problem of insecurity in Nigeria facing President Muhammadu Buhari has started attracting the attention of the legislators. Some members of the House of Representatives have invited the president to come and answer questions on the security situation in Nigeria. President Muhammadu Buhari says he will honor the invitation, but no definite date has been fixed for the meeting with the lawmakers. Experts believe that the ordinary Nigerian deserves peace and protection in Nigeria. Protection, they said, to freely go to his farm, harvest his crops so that he can feed his family. They said fear has now dominated the minds of many Nigerians in their homes, on their farms, and along highways where criminals kidnap and kill with impunity. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
It's being called the jobs report without a silver lining. United States corporate media is unable to put any positive spin on the number of new jobs produced in November, coming in at a whopping 60% under the initial prediction. It's the lowest monthly addition of jobs since April, coincides with a tripling in long-term unemployment since only September, and makes clear that temporary unemployment caused by coronavirus lockdowns have repeatedly led to permanent job losses.
The jobs report may be the final nail in the coffin of a so-called snapback economic recovery, which was so widely touted by the mainstream media last spring. A social recovery for the long-term unemployed and their dependents may prove to be just as difficult to achieve.
As seen following the 2008 recession in the U.S., the social effects of long-term unemployment include mental health problems, increased drug and alcohol addiction, an erosion of employable skills, and lasting family dysfunction. With stocks just having their best November ever, it's now clear that the U.S. has had a K-shaped recovery, with the rich and poor classes headed in opposite directions.
It's in shambles right now. There's no question about that. We're in the worst crisis for U.S. capitalism since the Great Depression. And this crisis isn't getting better. I mean, bills are compounding. Rent is compounding. It's not like things are getting better. For people who haven't been able to work, you know, they still have to pay. These numbers are still piling up. Medical bills are piling up. Utility bills are piling up.
The second wave of coronavirus has hit lockdowns, and not more funding for health care is again America's solution. The new lockdowns are being called a gift to Amazon by small local business groups, and will likely worsen the already bad unemployment situation just as they did in spring. At the same time, pandemic stimulus unemployment benefits are scheduled to run out the day after Christmas for 15 million people. Data from MIT University estimated that the Paycheck Protection Program, from the first and only federal stimulus plan, spent nearly $250,000 to save each job. However, the maximum compensation to workers was capped at $100,000. The annual median personal income is just $33,000. It's caused many to wonder where the money for jobs really went. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
Protests in Pakistan against the UAE was unthinkable until recently. However, now it is not so unusual after the UAE diplomatically recognized the apartheid regime of Israel. The public sentiments against several Arab rulers rose in Pakistan after the UAE and Bahrain started aligning their foreign policies with Israel and India. The normalization of Israel's ties with the UAE and Bahrain is now affecting Islamabad's long-standing relation with some Arab rulers, particularly of Saudi Arabia and UAE. Citing unspecified security threats and rise in coronavirus cases, the UAE now has banned visit and work visas to Pakistani citizens, along with 13 other Muslim nations, most of whom have been angry with Abu Dhabi after it normalized ties with Tel Aviv.
Countries like UAE receive such direct investment from investors from Israel and, for that matter, American Jewish community, then obviously the UAE government and the investors from Israel or, for that matter, USA would be cautious about how the local population, for that matter, how the immigrants might react and respond to direct presence of the Israeli or, for that matter, American Jewish investors in countries like UAE.
Without revealing their names, Prime Minister Imran Khan in a recent interview dropped a hint that Saudi Arabia and the UAE have been pressurizing Islamabad to normalize its ties with Israel. Islamabad has vowed not to give diplomatic recognition to Israel. Over 5 million Pakistanis work in UAE and Saudi Arabia, the two biggest remittance-generating Arab states.
Pakistan's economy is dependent on these remittances. Saudi Arabia and UAE have the tools in their hands to put pressure on Pakistan to recognize Israel. Pakistan's nuclear power has always been a problem for Israel. So therefore, Israel would love that Pakistan should give recognition to it. That's why UAE, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and other GCC countries want Pakistan to give recognition to Israel.
Political analysts say that Pakistan is running out of options, and in the current situation, it may inch closer to Turkey, Qatar, Iran, and more particularly to China to offset pressure from Saudi Arabia and UAE, which are strengthening their alliance with Israel, US, and India. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Due to the coronavirus pandemic, the European Defence Agency annual conference has taken place online. The event, which has just concluded, normally attracts protests as it brings together arms dealers, policymakers and politicians, while civil society representatives are banned. The usual rhetoric was peddled out at this year's conference, however.
We have to look together into the rise of China and also these issues. Speaking of Russia, they have developed, and they are developing as we speak, super advanced missile systems.
Campaigners say the EU and NATO create security threats to feed the arms industry, which is active in every one of the EU's 27 nations and has an annual turnover of more than 100 billion euro. The ongoing process to create an EU army means that even more taxpayers' money is being spent at a time when COVID-19 is pushing millions of citizens into poverty.
For the first time, we invest 8 billion euros of EU budget money in cooperative defence R&D project.
Activists describe the EU's arms industry as immoral.
Exporting weapons to the Saudi-led coalition, which is waging war on Yemen. You have
these huge amounts of money being made on the suffering of the Palestinian people.
Donald Trump's Make America Great Again slogan was mocked during the EU Defense Agency conference.
I very much hope that with Joe Biden, we will have a partner in making, we have already started saying, making multilateralism great again.
The anti-war movement is suggesting those who believe we will have a more just world under Joe Biden's presidency should examine the history books. The Obama-Biden team ordered 10 times more airstrikes using drones than the previous U.S. administration under George W. Bush. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Islamic Republic of Iran currently has the highest blood donation rate in the Eastern Mediterranean region, and out of almost 10 million donation units in this region, over 2 million is by the Iranians. These days, a campaign is launched in Tehran to collect blood from athletes to encourage other people to donate their blood. The campaign is being promoted by Sports Society of Basij in collaboration with the country's blood transfusion organization.
We have organized this event to give the opportunity to athletes and other people to donate their blood to improve the level of blood banks in the country.
Famous sportsmen also took part to convince ordinary people to be part of the Movable.
I am here today to donate my blood because it's a must for everyone to help the patients. Our country needs our blood as the bank reservoirs are running low. I call on my fellow countrymen to come and help and save lives.
I want to be part of this campaign to do the least I can do for those who need blood. This can also improve the health in our country. As the body of athletes is strong, their blood is of a better quality. I ask all the athletes to show up and assist.
Studies showed that the plasma taken from the recovered people can be used in treating the coronavirus patients. While blood donation in many countries still depends on replacement or paid donors, Iran is the first country in the region that has enjoyed voluntary blood donation by 100% since 2007. Human Abedi, Tehran.
The humanitarian crisis in Yemen has been exacerbated by the incessant war and siege over the past 6 years. The executive director of the World Food Programme, David Beasley, confirmed that the number of people facing the second highest level of food insecurity will increase from 3.6 million to 5 million in the first half of 2021.
There is indeed a humanitarian catastrophe, and if aid arrives, it goes to other places, and 70% of it goes to United Nations organizations to cover operational expenses. The other side must stop the blockade completely, because it affects Yemen in the medical, educational, and food sectors. So we think the focus should be on the root cause of the problem, which is the siege on Yemeni people.
Beasley called on the international community not to abandon the millions of families who are in severe need of aid. Millions of people are on the brink of a new famine as the UN's Yemen response faces historic shortfalls. $1.5 billion is what the donor governments contributed, while the UN says it needs $3.2 billion to avert the crisis.
Those who provide aid, such as the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and America, have failed and did not abide by their pledges they made. They spent more than these sums to buy weapons, but they do not help Yemenis as they claim, which confirms the authenticity of the United Nations reports that famine is on the rise in Yemen.
The coronavirus pandemic, along with the funding crunch, has forced dozens of aid agencies and organizations working in Yemen to scale back their assistance. Some of them even had to give up their programs entirely, which has deteriorated the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, according to the UN. Famine can still be prevented if the international community wakes up to take serious action to save the lives of millions in Yemen, including women and the children. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Thank
The coordination Stop Global Security Law organized a new popular march for liberties and for justice all over France. The protesters want a total withdrawal of a law recently voted in the French Parliament that limits the possibility to film the police. They also denounce an authoritarian drift of the French government.
That authoritarian drift is evident. Look to the proposed laws. The existing legal framework in France is more than sufficient to control everything they want to. Why do they add new laws? It's only to limit more the freedom of expression and to sanction activists.
Trade unions say that the French government is taking advantage of the COVID-19 crisis to implement anti-social and austerity measures. Measures like the privatization of the health sector and the dismissal of workers.
They use the Terrorist Act and the health crisis as an alibi for restrictive measures. Since last week, the head of police has forbidden a demonstration in the name of the COVID-19 crisis. This law has only one interest, to silence demonstrators.
Earlier this week, the Council of Ministers decided to close the main association against Islamophobia in France, the CCIF. French Interior Minister Darmanin qualified the CCIF as an enemy of the Republic and accused it of incitement to hatred and violence, discrimination, and of encouraging terrorism.
That's very surprising, because the CCIF has always profiled itself on the judicial scene and very little as political activists. The association limited itself to defend the legitimate rights of the Muslims. Now, in the context of an upsurge of terrorist attacks since 2015, the French government has entered in a phase of escalation of repressive measures that seriously limit the democratic liberties.
Amnesty International declared that dissolving the CCIF is a violation of freedom of association. As for now, the French government remains inflexible towards the social protest. But tensions are rising in high government circles about the way the security issue in France is handled. The protesters promise not to give up until an important part of the law is cancelled. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.org.